You're listening to the Vint Podcast, where we bring you interviews and stories from around the world of wine and spirits. From winemakers and critics to sommeliers and master distillers, we'll explore the people and businesses who are instrumental in shaping the future of today's food and drinks culture. Enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Vint Podcast. My name is Billy Galenko, and we have an excellent California-focused episode for you today. I have guest Matthew Crafton, who is the head winemaker at Chateau Montelena, based up in Calistoga in the north part of the Napa Valley. As many of you may know, Chateau Montelena is famous for being one of the wines that was included in the Judgment of Paris. It was the top scoring white wine in that tasting, and that kind of helped put Napa Valley wines on the map. As everybody knows, the importance of that tasting in Stephen Spurrier's time. And today, the quality still matches that of the very early days. In fact, it's come leaps and bounds since then. But the winery has been owned by the same family, the Barrett family. And today we have a really interesting conversation with Matt about their winemaking practice and basically how they've been balancing heritage and technology to both constantly improve the quality of the wine while also expressing the unique expressions of their vineyards, both their estate vineyards and the ones that they've been working with for decades and decades to really bring out the true character of each site. Before we get to the interview with Matt, I wanted to do a quick little rundown. We get kind of wine nerdy in there. Without Brady on the podcast, I go down some really wine nerd questions. So I wanted to give you guys a little bit of a primer ahead of our chat with Matt about barrels. We get into a little bit of detail on talking about the types of barrels they use, the quality of the oak, where the oak comes from, all of that jazz. So I really wanted just to give a quick TLDR on the importance of oak and why it's used. Many wines, both white and red, are aged in oak barrels. This oak can come from a number of different sources. The most famous, and I'm sure everybody's familiar with quote-unquote French oak, that gives off a certain profile. Every location has its own kind of profile that therefore is in part to oak. American oak is known for more vanillins forward. French oak is known for more of that spice, the baking spices. And wherever you go throughout Europe, whether it be Central or Eastern Europe, everywhere has its own little bit of essence. And that can actually be played out even to a deeper level. In France, for example, there are a handful of famous forests that actually Matt talks about in our podcast, because Chateau Montelena only uses French oak. There are forests Nevers, Betrange, the Vosges, and Limousine, which is funny because it sounds like limousine, but that's how it's pronounced, or it's probably Limousin. But when we're talking about it in the podcast, Matt refers to it as limousine. And what's interesting to me is all of these little nuances, most people just gloss over them and call them French oak, when there's really a lot of detail, a lot of careful consideration going on in the background at the wineries of not only what country to pick the oak from, but which forest, which cooper, even just the base raw materials for your barrels. A lot of thought and consideration goes into that. And producers, and Matt will talk about this a little bit, they don't even just buy one all from one forest. They'll mix and match. They'll use these flavor profiles as ingredients and balance out the flavor of their wines. Forest, location, where it comes from, country, that is part one about what kind of makes a barrel taste a certain way. The second part that we talk about a lot in the podcast are toasting barrels. You may have seen the old kind of technique of a barrel kind of loosely made being held over like a mini flamethrower, not quite flamethrower, but it's basically a flame on the ground coming out of a round pot. And the cooper will just turn the barrel around this flame. They'll flip it over to get a certain level of toast within the barrel. And Matt mentions the more modern day version of this is you can just put electric heaters in there now and really dial in the level of toast. And when we say toast, what that really means is there's certain sugars and other carbohydrates that are in the wood. When you expose those to heat over time, just kind of like when you're cooking, these carbohydrates and sugars caramelize. So that is how you bring out this spice, this vanilla, and the other notes that everybody knows in oak. You might also be familiar with the same flavors in bourbon, for example. Bourbon has to be 100% charred oak, American oak barrels that it's made in. You can just take a guess about how the types of flavors that you're getting when you char it that much, if it can basically turn a raw spirit into what you get with bourbon, that's what's happening when you're toasting wine barrels as well. So there's a very basic low, medium, high toast and every sort of like numbers and levels in between where you can really dial into the specific amount of toast you want, how much flavor you want that oak to impart, that barrel to impart to your wine. And as we move from the early 2000s, late 90s, you've seen winemakers become more and more judicious with the amount of new oak they're using or the toast that's on those new oak when they're using those oaks. So the toast is a really important like aspect and something that can be calibrated for imparting flavor to wine. And Matt talks a lot about how they carefully dial in the amount of toast that they're going for, and they're leaning more towards less toast. And then that brings me to the next part of what an oak barrel kind of imparts just from the raw materials alone is structure. So people know that if you have a red wine and it has tannins, what a lot of people don't think about are that new oak barrels also impart tannins. A lot of these are really fine grain tannins. They'll help set the color in red wines. They'll bond with some of the other long chains of amino acids and tannin chains that are in red wines. But then they'll also help give this not only flavor and spice, but a little bit of structure to your Chardonnays or other white wines that are made in oak barrels as well. That's something people don't really think about as much is the tannin that's actually coming from the barrel itself. Everybody thinks of the wine sitting in oak barrels and slowly being exposed to oxygen and softening over time, which does happen. But they also impart this tannin, especially with these new barrels, that helps set the structure and help really, really define the kind of texture that you're getting in a wine itself. Another aspect that has to do both with the tannin that the barrel imparts, the flavor that the barrel imparts, is the coarseness of the grain, how tight the grain is in the oak that's used in the barrel. This actually goes back again to the original kind of beginning of this talk with the regions having different tightness of grains. Oak from even within tree to tree varies in grains, but for the large part, just broadly speaking, French oak is known for being very tight grained. There are some Eastern European grains that are a little looser, depending on where you get yours from in the US, it's also looser. And what happens with these looser grains is that the wine is more easily able to penetrate into the wood itself. So as it's more able to penetrate in, it takes more flavor back out as the wine goes in and out over the aging process. So the tighter the grain, the less penetrable the barrel itself is, less flavor it'll impart in return. But also the same with the tannins that you get out of it are going to be different from a tight grain to a coarse grain barrel, which Matt also brings up. And that's just another key aspect to when somebody's considering where do they want to get their oak from? How much are they going to toast it? You have to take into account all these variables. How much flavor is already going to come out of it because of its grain? How much will the toasting enhance that? And then the last variable in terms of flavor, or the last thing I want you guys to think about that we touch on in the podcast, is time. And there's two elements of time. One aspect is how long does the wine stay in that barrel? So a longer time exposed to a new French oak that's medium toasted barrel will impart much more flavor than, say, if that's a year and a half, maybe 6 months in the same barrel, or it'll impart the different amount than a year and a half in a low toast new French oak barrel would. It's very interesting to think of that element of time. It's basically how much in this barrel and then how many uses is a barrel. You note I'm saying new oak barrel. A barrel will give its most flavor, obviously, when it's brand new. Second use barrels will give some flavor, not quite as much, but some people really kind of like that moderate tone of oak that comes out of a second use barrel. And then by the end of the third use and even the beginning of the third use, you're not getting a ton of flavor. And by the end, it's a completely neutral barrel that can be used to add different qualities to the wine, help round out the wines in terms of you want to let oxygen in a little bit more, depending on how you treat the barrels. And Matt kind of talks about a lot of this information as well. And I think I hadn't really thought about barrels in a long time and all of the elements and the nuances that can go into them. Just talking to somebody at a wine shop, you really just want to know how much time in barrel, was it French or was it American? And you get the TLDR, but once you start really digging down into each of the little variables that can be tweaked even before the barrel gets to the winery, It's absolutely amazing. And then thinking that the winemakers are choosing different barrels to match different lots, the level of attention to detail and minutia that goes into making some of these top tier wines is mind-blowing. So that brings me right to my conversation with Matt. I think the level of detail that goes into making the wines at Chateau Montelena was mind-boggling. I actually had no idea. Between the efforts that they put in the vineyard to specifically farm different plots certain ways, the thought that's gone into replanting part of the vineyard, the careful attention to detail that goes on in the winery, both taking care of the wine and also taking care of their employees is fascinating. And we cover all of this. So I hope everybody enjoys it. We chatted for almost an hour. I could have gone on forever. So I hope everybody enjoys this really kind of wine nerd winemaking episode and really learns a lot about Chateau Montelena, their property in Calistoga, the wines that they're making from elsewhere as well. Without further ado, here is Matt, head winemaker at Chateau Montelena. Hi, Matt. Thanks so much for joining today.
Hey, my pleasure. Happy to be here, Billy.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to having, you're actually our first, I guess Ridge technically counts, but you're our first podium member from the Judgment of Paris, the first winery from the Judgment of Paris to come on the podcast. I've been looking forward to this for a long time, and I think it would be fitting for you first to give a little bit of history of yourself and then of the winery, since it is so storied, and then we can dive into what's going on today and what you guys are looking for in the future.
Sure. So brief background on me. I'm from Virginia, grew up in the DC area. Been in wine production for a little over 20 years now. Got into winemaking like so many other people did. Just it was a side hustle that got out of control that I never thought I would end up making a career in, but started off in the Virginia wine industry at the very bottom and then eventually made my way out here to California. Got a graduate degree from UC Davis. I've worked in Sonoma and Napa, and I've been fortunate enough to be with Montelena for the last 15 years. And I've been head winemaker since 2014.
Oh, wow. Sad that my co-host Brady is not here. He's a big Virginia wine fan. And I'm originally from Virginia too, actually. You didn't know that.
I didn't know that. Where are you from?
I was born in Alexandria and grew up in Virginia Beach. So
right on. So born in Richmond, grew up in Fairfax.
Wow. All right.
Yeah, worlds.
Yeah, we're going to have to connect on that offline because I went to grad school in Richmond. But cool. I think let's start where everybody knows for Chateau Montelena. But obviously the winery existed a little bit a while before the Judgment of Paris. And the main thing that stood out to me when I was reading that book was the owners who bought it, or I guess led it through that time, used to fly up from Los Angeles. Is that right? They were like lawyers and they like lived in like Rancho Palos Verdes or something. And then they would just like fly up and manage the winery. Is that accurate, or am I making that up?
No, you're spot on. So the winery was founded in 1882. There were quite a few wineries in Napa Valley in the late 19th century. Prohibition essentially kills the American wine industry. And then with the exception of a few notable places, including Charles Krug and then eventually Robert Mondavi and a few others. But the rebirth really happens with the class of 1972. And we can get into the whys if you want on that. But there are quite a few wineries that were started in that year. And one of them was Montelena. So Jim Barrett and a few of his partners who were down in Southern California, down in Palos Verdes, they purchased this old, abandoned, rundown ghost winery and this dilapidated vineyard in 1972 and began the rebirth that was chronicled in so many books and obviously culminated in the Judgment of Paris a few years later. But yeah, in the early years, Jim was flying back and forth between Southern California and Calistoga.
Nice. Yeah. No, I remember them describing themselves compared to the French people as just like salt of the earth farmers just trying to scrape by. And I was like, dude, you're still flying up on a plane. So I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah. I think at the time there was American agriculture was really in a troubled state. And in an example of for once really good federal tax policy, the Nixon administration offered a federal tax credit for reinvestments in agriculture. And that's why you see us and Jordan and the Duncans at Silver Oak and quite a few other wineries all coming into existence right at the same time in the early 1970s. And so, yeah, to your point, there weren't any subsistence farmers, but there were people who were interested in the back to the land movement, which is a really good thing.
Awesome. Can you bridge the gap for us from the 70s to now? And then what has been these through lines in terms of the winemaking philosophy and obviously the vineyard footprint itself and how you've, and then we'll talk into how you massage that and made it your own as we've gone forward.
Yeah. So Mobsalana thankfully has a pretty uninterrupted line since then. So Jim Barrett, who purchased the winery in 1972, he passed in 2013, but we're still owned by the Barrett family. Jim's son, Bo, who was our winemaker, our third winemaker, is the CEO of the company right now. He's my boss. And since then, it's the company's obviously, the winery's really blossomed. We don't make any more wine than we did in like the 1980s. I think people think we're a lot bigger than we are. But there have been five winemakers in our history. So starting off with Mike Gergich, Jerry Looper, Bo, my predecessor, Cameron Perry, and then myself. And I think one strength of this brand and this place is that we understand that the hand of man, the hand of a person, of a winemaker, is an integral part of terroir. And so while everybody has their own spin on things, we are starting off with wonderful vineyards, places to grow, and being able to recognize and utilize those assets as something really special.
Can you either paint the picture and also just like locate where Chateau Montalena is? Because I wasn't aware it was all the way up there by Calistoga.
Yeah, that's right. So the valley's roughly 30 miles long. It's shaped like a banana. We are at the most northern point in Napa Valley. We're all the way at the top of the valley in Calistoga. And we sit essentially at where the confluence of the Vaca mountain range on the east side, which is primarily volcanic, and the Mayacamas on the west side all come together. And we sit right at the base of Mount St. Helena, which is essentially the defining geographical and topological feature in the valley. So Mount Helena is actually a contraction of Mount St. Helena. And so that's where the name comes from. So yeah, so we're all the way at the top of the valley. Always drink upstream of the herd is what we say.
I guess also when people think of Calistoga, they think it's much hotter, much warmer up there. Are you guys sitting at some elevation, or how do you guys get the brightness in your wines?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there is like most things in life, there's a rule of thumb that's like partially correct and partially incorrect, where everyone assumes that the valley gets warmer from south to north, and overall it does. But if you look at the actual, you know, temperature data, and there have been a number of studies that have exemplified this or have certainly illustrated it. The warmest part of the valley is actually the east side of St. Helena. And the reason that Calistoga isn't the warmest is because there's a gap essentially on the west side of Calistoga that allows fog to come in through Russian River and Alexander Valley. So if you look at the two sources of cool air coming in into Calistoga, one of them is that gap that pulls in the Pacific fog. And the second one is in the afternoons. As the air cools down, as the sun goes down, we actually see and feel air coming down off Mount St. Helena. It rumbles right down around 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon every day during the summer, and it cools the vineyard off. And so we'll see a temperature gap or a temperature differential on our property compared to, let's say, in town in Calistoga, which is just a few miles away, of up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's pretty considerable. You talk to anyone who works in viticulture in either Napa or Sonoma, and they'll tell you that Calistoga is a weird place. We're so like topologically and topographically diverse, with all different aspects and slopes and elevations and everything else. It's hard to really pinpoint to characterize what we are specifically.
Hmm. Is all of your fruit that goes into your wines, is it all from one estate? And is it one like cohesive estate, or do you guys have plots around Calistoga?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we have our estate vineyard is essentially contiguous with the winery. We have about 100 planted acres. We have a few small leased properties that are nearby, but we farm our Chardonnay, obviously, further south in Oak Knoll. That's a much more appropriate place for Chardonnay. But all the Bordelais varieties, everything comes from up here.
Ah, that was going to be my question, because I've read through the tech note, but I didn't exactly see exactly where the Chardonnay was. And I was like,
it's not there.
Yeah, they're working some magic, it's not there. I guess in the Bordelais varieties, I noticed your, the cab, at least the one that I just got to taste, and we can talk about that in particular, I think it's the 2019, there was only like 0.5% Petit Verdot and like 0.5% Cab Franc. So is do you guys have like two rows of each, or is that just a choice for that year?
That's a really good question. So the way I look at things, we only really have two directives in terms of how we make wine. And it's that the wines have to be delicious and they have to age. That's it. So there are no stylistic parameters. There's nothing related to a cooperage profile. In fact, like I don't even taste previous year's blends when I'm making the current one. I'm not looking for any sort of homogeneity across different vintages. If anything, my goal is really to show off the nuances of the vintage, show off the nuances of the vineyard. And not everybody can do that. It's trying to create really a wine of place that can't be copied. And so when it comes down to blending, it's we have more Petit Verdot, we have more Cabernet Franc. But the way we look at blending is that it's not necessarily, blending isn't used in the way it is in other parts of the world where a Cabernet Franc or Petit Verdot Merlot is to spackle over a low point or make up for some deficiency. The way we look at it is that it's an expression of place. And so different varieties will express that place and that vintage in different ways. And so what you're looking for is with those other varieties is that heightened expression of the vintage and that heightened expression of place. And so sometimes you just need little dashes like salt and pepper. Some years you need more than that. Or let's say the wine would benefit from more than that from a creative standpoint, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely. So for that particular vintage, I don't know if you know it as well off the top of your head, 2019, mm-hmm. but it was very well balanced. I know the Techno really hyped up the perfume on the nose, but it was interesting. I tasted it like out of the bottle and then I put it in the fridge for a while. And it was really interesting to both smell it and taste it as it warmed up. Totally. That really, really came out. Do you think it was the Petit Verdot adding a little bit of like depth of color and a little bit of the, I don't know, Cab Franc adding like the floral? I don't always think of Cab Franc as floral, but I'm just wondering what do you think those two bits added to that? And then what did you get out of the vintage as well? I read your notes, but.
Yeah, I think this property in general has incredible aromatic potential in the fruit. And so that's a characteristic of the place. And so it's our job essentially to be able to like nurture that and preserve it. And so a lot of the winemaking goes into being able to do that. In terms of your comment, in terms of chilled versus warm, I think the reason we were told early on to drink wine like cold is basically was the result of boozy, high alcohol, Cabernet and Chardonnay entering the market, and low temps can mask a lot of those problems. I actually drink our wine closer to room temperature, and I find that they tend to be so much more perfumey and open. But that said, if you're going to do that, you can't have a wine that's out of balance. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if it's a trademark. I see it as more of a feature rather than a flaw. So you don't have to drink our wine at cellar temperature, 55 degrees. You don't have to drink it at 35. The wine's really going to express itself closer to that. In terms of Petit Verdot and Cabernet Franc, the Cabernet Franc we have, the Clone 327, does tend to be a little bit more aromatic, but it isn't aromatic in the way that most people think. So Cabernet Franc, obviously being one of the parents of Cabernet Sauvignon, tends to be a little bit more briery and a little bit more herbal. And I think that's a really good thing. I think you should have varietal character in your wine. The Petit Verdot on this property, at least, which is the Clone 400, it doesn't have as rich of an aromatic profile as, in general, as Cabernet Sauvignon or the Cabernet Franc. Instead, our Petit Verdot tends to express much more texturally. And so some years that texture can be usually the tannin profile, whether it's like very like fine grain or sandy or silky, it's usually some sort of textural component rather than something aromatic.
Hmm.
But that's a very broad generalization.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally understand that. Yeah. No, I think I completely agree with your assessment there of the temperature. Mm-hmm. It's interesting in some wines, whether it be from Napa or some of these bigger wines, when you do chill it, you do feel not like it's more balanced, but obviously the acid shines a little bit more. But yours, even really cold, I don't think it didn't really feel like the acid was overburdening. And then as it warmed up, it basically stayed in what came was more of the fruit and the floral kind of rounding it out, but it never really tasted out of balance. It never was like, oh, here's the acid. Okay, now the acid's gone or, you know, lost. It was interesting. It was balanced all the way through. It was just what you got on the nose varied in on the palate. Before we move on to the Chardonnay, I wanted to ask a little bit about that vineyard. You guys had a big replanting not too long ago. Can you walk us through the impetus of that, what the goal is on the outcome or on the outside, and then where we are in terms of that process?
Yeah, totally. So the first real planting of this property in the modern era was in the early 1970s. And at the time, it's your first swing of the bat in the vineyard. I can only imagine what it was like. And it's great. Actually, I don't even have to imagine. I can ask Bo because he was here, and how they laid out blocks, and you had choice of St. George or AXR1 rootstock. That was it. And you got budwood from your neighbor. And it was just that was the first swing of the bat in developing a vineyard. And then over time, individual blocks have been replanted in sort of small pieces, more on an iterative basis in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s. But as we were approaching the 50th anniversary of the modern era of Montalena in 22, we were really talking about what's it going to take to build this property and build this brand for the next 50 years. And the Bordelais have a rule of thumb that it takes 3 plantings before you really know your piece of ground. And so it was with Bo's approval, being able to take a very methodical look on the individual facets of this property, because we know so much more now. We know what's going on below ground. We have subsurface soil maps. We know how the property's been picked over the last 50 years. We know we have so much more information, so much more data that's like very, very actionable. We wanted to look at everything in a very cohesive way. And we began the process in basically 2018, 2019, and we're doing a full assessment of what is the potential of each individual block on the block level, on the row level, looking at the individual soil gradients, all of those sorts of things, with the idea that this property has additional potential and how can we really maximize that. So it's been entirely quality driven. I hope that's coming across.
No, for sure. So were you did you make different decisions in terms of the plant material based on the different parts of the vineyard? Are you mixing up rootstocks? How did that impact you?
That's a great question. So we essentially started with a blank slate and looking at starting off below ground. What do we know? What do we need to know? So this is a ton of background work. It's soil pits, it's soil resistivity. It's looking at obviously different layers of soil, and then also looking at historically, how is the block performed? How does it express? And so there's a hierarchy in terms of what's really important in terms of driving quality in your vineyard. And the soil is obviously that the foundation of that. And then moving, I say, down in importance, rootstocks, incredibly important, matching that to your soil type. And then, you know, the variety, making sure that you put the right grape in the right place. And then there's training method and trellis and row orientation. And then you finally get to clone as the cherry on top. So it was really just being explicitly purposeful, moving through each of those individual facets and making decisions that were appropriate for each individual block, but also had the maximum, you know, potential for the future. So yes, like everything was on the table. And so we're reorienting all of our rows 25 to 26 degrees east of north. We're playing around with row spacing, obviously rootstock. We're looking for pest and disease resistance as well as drought tolerance. Looking at how we plumb our irrigation, all of those sorts of things, everything is on the table. And we're trying to get to do it in a way that's either hopefully data driven or at a very minimum based off of the institutional knowledge and experience that we have here.
One question I always have for folks when they're replanting, especially on such a large scale, is are you doing it in phases? How do you keep enough vines to make wine? And knowing that it takes 3 years for it to at least come online to make wine again.
Yeah, totally. And that's exactly it. We couldn't rip everything out. And I tell people that like any project in viticulture and winemaking is like a decade long, because by the time you're doing the prep work and you get everything done and developed and planted, and by the time you make the wine and then it has to age and then release, it's 10 years. And so, yeah, we started exactly that way. We started in 2019 with the first two initial blocks. And it's just been this very methodical process where we're looking at, okay, we can take this block offline because this other one's coming online, and you know, trying to guesstimate how yields are going to look. And obviously, you don't want to get slammed with a lot of tonnage right off the bat. You don't want to lose a whole bunch of tonnage right off the bat either. So it's a bit of a balance. And I think we've done a pretty good job on it. But we're about, I'd say, 3/4 of the way through at this point. I think the last block to get ripped out and replanted will probably be in like the 2026 timeframe, maybe 2027, depending on how things are shaking out. But it's been an amazing process. It's just the level of precision we have now in looking at like vineyard, raising your fruit quality is like the number one driver of raising your wine quality. It's that simple. And we're also like, we live in a world of diminishing marginal returns. So it's like the low hanging fruit, so to speak, is gone. So we're investing thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars just to make the fruit like that little bit better, because that's what you need to do. And so it's really fun, but it's also a bit of a grind.
Yeah, for sure. I'm going to try not to ask. I have like fine spacing questions and everything. I'll probably just save those for after to spare our audience here. But I will say, in terms of the actual fruit itself, is it interesting to compare, now that like some of the vines are old enough to actually produce winemaking quality fruit, to compare that to some of the older blocks that are remaining? And is there like, do the bunches look slightly different? Are the grape sizes different? How is that? How's the quality as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so the one constant we have is the land. So we want to use that to its maximum potential from a quality standpoint. And so yes, we changed the row spacing to actually ask each vine to do less than what it was doing before. But interestingly, because of the way things are spaced now, we actually get more fruit per acre. So the vines aren't working as hard. They're definitely more resilient. The fruit quality is better, but we're also getting more yield, which is a neat paradigm to be in. But yeah, so you look at, especially with clonal selection and those things, we do see different cluster morphology. We see different phenolic profiles. And I think that's probably a really big take home for us, is when I took over in 2014, one of the big goals was making sure we like lynch together, put a linchpin in between viticulture and winemaking here. So at most wineries, for some reason, like, you have a vineyard team and you have a winemaking team, and they don't always talk or play nice, or maybe they have conflicting goals. And I really wanted to make sure that we were all on the same page and rowing in the right direction. So it's like, now when we make a decision in the vineyard, even whether it from a planting standpoint, or let's say something we're doing during the year, we're obviously tasting it, and your mouth's the most important instrument. But at the same time, we also can measure quantitatively those changes as well. And that feedback loop between what we're tasting in the winery and being able to provide that very specific feedback back to my vineyard manager about what we did that was maybe right or maybe could be better is really important in getting better. And so that's something we've really focused on over the last few years.
Hmm. Were you impacted by fires at all in recent years? Like, any smoke coming up or anything like that?
Yeah, so we lost all of our red fruit in 2020. So we didn't even pick a single red grape. So,
oh wow,
we lost that whole vintage.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I thought it was up there, but I didn't want to. Sorry to touch on a sore spot there.
It's all good. It was a straight up integrity question. We know how smoke works. We know that it's insidious nature, and we weren't going to put ourselves in a position where we could possibly compromise our integrity with our customers. It was a hard decision, and it was an expensive decision, but it was the right one to make.
Yeah. For those who have listened to the Rich episode too, we talked briefly about it there too. And it's so interesting that you can't do anything with it. Even if you did want to make a weird distilled smoky beverage, if you want to get your insurance, you got to just cut it off. Interesting. Cool. So let's move on from your estate property down to the Chardonnay as well. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear more about like where exactly like in Oak Knoll that is, and how long you guys have been working with that vineyard as well, or if it's owned by you guys.
Yeah, that's a good question. So when Montalena started making Chardonnay in 1972, you have to remember, or at least how I didn't know this, and you're too young to remember this, actually, so am I, but there was more Riesling in Napa Valley than there was Chardonnay back in the early 70s. And so finding Chardonnay was pretty tough. And so for the first few years, the Chardonnay was really somewhat of a mutt. It was about 40% coming from Napa. It was Oak Knoll. There was a small vineyard in Calistoga, believe it or not. There was fruit coming from what's now Alexander Valley and then Russian River as well. And after the Judgment of Paris, the TTB decided, this the federal, the U.S. Tax and Trade Bureau, which is what governs the wine industry, decided that joint appellated wines, so wines with two appellations, weren't going to work without some very specific restrictions. And so consequently, the federal government essentially killed the famous 73 Chardonnay. So we were forced to essentially make two wines. We made a Sonoma Chardonnay for a short period of time, and then we made our Napa. And so over time, we decided to focus specifically on Napa. And one of those original vineyards that was in the 1973 was located in Oak Knoll. So this is on the west side at the drainage of the air drainage coming off of Mount Veeder. And so that wine, that vineyard has always come to Montalena since 1972. So over time, we've started to pick up vineyards either through leases or contracts or something like that in that area. And that really is the foundation, the bedrock of the Montalena Chardonnay. We do have a vineyard in Coombsville, east of Napa, in an interesting spot. Most of the fruit in Coombsville now is Cabernet, but we're in this like little drainage where all the cold air from the entire AVA seems to drain right through this vineyard. So it's a great spot for Chardonnay, except in frost years, it's not so great. But yeah, so it's definitely the Chardonnay is a down valley wine, that's for sure.
Interesting. That makes me think of, I guess they call them combs in Burgundy. There are these, you know, little areas that funnel air and water as well.
It's exactly what it is. It's exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Nice. So, yeah. So can you talk a little bit about how you guys go about making that Chardonnay too? Because for a Napa Valley Chardonnay, it's very fresh and you know, very well balanced. So it's must be difficult, not difficult to attain, but I'm sure that goes into the farming and the winemaking choices and, you know.
Definitely. And I think it goes back to that original statement that I said where the wine just has to be delicious and it has to age. And so the easiest thing for a winemaker to do is just to throw a big heavy barrel at any of your wines, or maybe go crazy with excess barrel stirring, bottinage, and you end up creating this, again, very homogenized product. But the way I look at things is entirely different. So with all of our wines, from Chardonnay to Cabernet to Zinfandel to Riesling, we remake like these wines every year from scratch. Like the first year I took over in 2014, I, you know, figuratively and literally threw the SOP books in the trash can. So every year, based on how the growing season progresses, how things taste, we start from scratch. And so on the Chardonnay side, there's a farming component to that, obviously, but on the winemaking side, which is probably more specific to what you're interested in, there are a ton of one-way doors in winemaking, as I'm sure, how we pick the fruit, whole cluster versus destemmed, oak selection, fermentation temperature, all of those things. All of that gets decided essentially by me as the vintage progresses. So it's a lot to do at once, but what you end up with are wines that have this common seam through them in terms of you can recognize them as Montalena, but the warm vintages are very different from the cool vintages. It's really just the vineyard, and then hopefully we've worked hard enough to make ourselves disappear, which is hard to do, so that you can actually enjoy that very specific annual expression of that fruit. So that's the logic behind it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, completely. Are you fermenting the different lots separately and then blending, or are you pre-blending?
Yeah, so with Cabernet, I do an assemblage. So after malolactic is completed, we do taste through everything blind, and then we will do a pre-blend and assemblage on that. But with the white varieties, I keep the individual lots separate. And I think it's more of just, I like, in terms of keeping them Surlys, keeping the barrel program and the élevage program relatively reductive. I think that really helps with the aromatics and helps to maintain that freshness. And so that's really more of the logic behind it than anything else.
Yeah. I wish Brady was here. Our company has an ongoing, which I think it's pretty well documented, but the parallel between reductive winemaking approach and minerality perception on the palate.
Definitely.
And I think that actually really comes through in the wines.
Thank you.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about the 2021 vintage specifically for the Chardonnay, since that's the one
Totally. You know, 2021, coming off 2020, we were just happy to get like decent yield, beautiful, moderately warm vintage. And as we start to taste through, I'm usually in the vineyard really early, let's say July, like August, starting to taste through this fruit. And I think most people, when they think about how fruit or vegetables ripen, they picture like a peach where there's this apogee all of a sudden where this peach is perfectly ripe, or let's say a tomato in your garden when a tomato is unripe and then all of a sudden it's ripe and you're like, you got to get it. For me, wine grapes aren't really like that. Wine grapes ripen more like music. It's more of like a wave that flows over time. And so there are these picking windows, and where when you're tasting through it, you're looking at obviously flavor development, you're looking at acid, With red grapes, you're looking at phenolics as you're tasting them, and you're looking for that word that we've already mentioned a couple of times, which is balance, coming back. And so there are these individual picking windows. And as the fruit obviously ripens over time, that perception of sweetness, that perception of flavor, so those all tend to move. And so 21 was really interesting because we were able to utilize a number of those different picking windows. So there's no, oh my gosh, we hit 22 bricks, pick it now. And people ask me all the time, they're like, what do you pick Chardonnay at? I said, pick Chardonnay whatever I want to pick. There are some years where we're picking in the high 21s. There are certain years where we're picking in the high 22s. There are certain years where I've picked over certain blocks in 23, because you're looking for that. It's almost like that fabric of flavor. You're painting with all of these different colors, because in the way we make wine here, the barrels are never the star. We're not stirring barrels constantly to build up a lot of B vitamin character and lazy character. That's not the star. It's really the vineyard and it's the vintage that's the star. And so the way we do that is by exploring all of those different colors. And so with 21, given how the harvest progressed, we were able to get into some of those individual blocks early. There are a few clones that I have planted down there that do tend to really show beautiful flavor at low sugar. And those are quite lovely. Those tend to be some of the Dijon clones. And then over time, as we start getting into harvest, some of those, getting further into harvest, those older vines, some of the ones from the early 80s or mid 80s, those tend to take a little bit longer to ripen. Those are like the old, like hardy clone 4 Chardonnay, like the UC Davis clones. Those two tend to take a little bit longer to come around. And so it's really about weaving those fabric of flavors together in a way that's like very compelling, but also like very cohesive. And you touched on it briefly, I think, with the Cabernet, is that you take a glass, taste a glass of our wine, put it in the fridge or put it on your counter, bring it back, pour another glass, and it's fundamentally different. It's different in a beautiful way, though. And so to me, that's like the highest compliment someone can give. Is that's why I'm not really a huge advocate for decanting. It's just that, no, experience the bloom on the rose. Have that first glass, enjoy it. By the time you get to that third glass or fourth glass, that wine should be showing something else that's maybe equally interesting, but also fundamentally different.
Yep. I can't agree more. I did the same process with a Chardonnay, and I 100% agree. I think it's great in both sides, but they are very, very different experiences, which to your point, they should be.
I was just going to add, I said, it's the same thing even with cooperage. We'll buy a minimum number of barrels every year, then we'll augment based on with specific barrels, specific toasts, specific coopers, based on how the vintage is progressing. And so you'll see like our new oak varies considerably year over year. Like we've been as low on the Chardonnay as 8% in some of the really cool vintages like 2011. And we're up at 30% in some of the warmer years. But it's not, new barrels aren't apples to apples anymore like they were maybe 30 years ago in varying the toast level. Some of our brand new barrels really don't have much of an aroma or even like pure oak impact anymore. So it's a very, very fine-tuned, very intricate process.
That's very interesting. Can you talk a little bit more, maybe explain to our audience kind of what the toast levels mean? And then also just even for my edification, what the point of using a brand new barrel if you're just looking for very subtle oak influences?
Yeah, that's a really good question also. So I think we've used in the industry this new oak percentage as some sort of barometer for how the wine is going to taste or maybe how the oak's going to be perceived in the wine. That's been very common since the 1970s. I don't really like it because back then there were maybe 3 or 4 coopers. You had choice between French and American oak, and everybody toasted the heck out of their barrels to maximize impact for the money, right? And so now there are dozens of coopers that import or that export from France into the US. We're not even going to talk about the other areas, just talk about France. And then among those coopers, there are probably, they started to recognize in the 1980s differences among individual forests. We have Troncay, we have Allier, we have Juppé, we have Limousin, all these. And then a decade later, the coopers recognize what's maybe not even in the forest, there are differences in grain tightness among individual trees, and that has an effect on things. And so, and then recently there are coopers that are starting to measure tannin potential in specific woods. So now we have France, Juppé, ultra fine grain, medium tannin potential. Just the permutations are wild. And that's even before you get into to toast. And then toasting can be everything from the traditional, you've got the French guy Jacques smoking a cigarette, rolling a barrel over the top of a fire and saying, ah, that looks about medium to me. There are coopers who still do that, and we still buy those barrels. And then there's some newer coopers where everything is convection toasted, and it's all done where they have an incredible amount of precision. If you don't want any smoky characteristic in your barrel, you don't want any furfurols, well, don't let the temperature get above 160 degrees centigrade, and you won't have any smoke in your barrel. So it's amazing the level of precision you can get into. The reason I bring that up is because, first off, it's a deep dive. But second of all, the way we look at oak here is that it's, again, it's a spice, but that there is really no one barrel, quote unquote, to rule them all. Every barrel that I have in any of my individual wines is there for a very, very specific purpose. Some barrels do help add, can help lift the mid palate of the wine, help the fruit to express better. Other barrels do provide a little bit of interest on the aroma. Some barrels can help extend the finish of a wine, but these are all like very, very subtle tweaks. And so depending upon the vintage, we will tweak those. We will add certain barrels, low toast, medium toast, high toast, or even something that's very specific numerically based on what would help accentuate the characteristics of the vineyard and that vintage. So again, it's not there in the masking role. It's more of a supporting role, if that makes sense. And so that's an incredibly important part of what we do. And if you come and visit at some point, which I hope you do, and you come into the cave, you'll see that we have, for certain vintages, you'll notice there's more of certain specific barrels on a specific wine because of the vintage characteristic. That's not because like I got a deal or that we needed extra barrels in a pinch and I had to buy as many as I could as quickly as I could. No, it's very, very purposeful. That hopefully it comes across in what we're talking about.
For sure. So what can you describe a little bit about what a new, and I feel like this is actually happening in whiskey too, but what a new barrel that is maybe very lightly toasted or like minimum toast kind of imparts, is that more just going to be a mouthfeel thing rather than, because it's not getting any of those caramels or vanillins that might come out with a heavier toast?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so it's definitely much more textural, definitely not nearly as much of an aromatic impact, and certainly not as much of a flavor impact. So we'll lean, if I had to overgeneralize, I tend to lean into more lower toast barrels for our State Cabernet, which is our vineyard designate. And certainly I tend to lean into them a little bit more in cooler vintages as well. And so again, you don't want to overwhelm the sense of place. If you think about just wines in general, there are essentially two kinds of wine, and I'm borrowing this from Randall Graham. Every wine can be characterized as either a wine of place or a wine of effort. And if you look by volume, the vast majority, probably 99% of volume of wines are wines of effort, where there is no site. It's just like California, or it's Spain, or Australia, or something like that. And it's the winemaking that actually creates a profile. And those wines tend to be more of like the Coca-Cola style of, I hate to say that term because I've made those wines before, but where it's about maintaining a consistent flavor profile year over year. But when you're trying to make a wine of place, that totally changes your outlook, not only in barrels, but also in fermentation, where all of a sudden you're not treating every single block or every single lot the same way. We'll pick this property here for Cabernet 40 times, 50 times. Some of these lots are tiny, half ton, 2 tons. Some of them are 6 tons, just depending on how things ripen. But the whole cellar is set up for flexibility, so that we can treat every single individual pick in a way that's going to maximize its own expressive potential. So I'm not going to ask one of my aromatic blocks to be like big and macho and really powerful. And same thing, I'm not going to ask one of my textural blocks to really knock it out of the park with aromatics. It's that symphony of those flavors, those colors, those aromas, everything coming together. That's what makes a really beautiful wine of place. And that's a really critical thing when you think about Montalena wines and how they age. It's that all that work we do on the front end that allows those bottles to go 20, 30, 40 years on both whites and reds.
All right. Well, we're getting closer to the the end of our time. But before we move on, I have one more barrel question. What is the difference between what you're getting out more of the lightly toasted new barrel and say, I don't want to just say 1 year, but maybe a 2 or 3 year or even a neutral barrel? I guess let's just say neutral barrel and the light one. Is it purely the texture that you're not getting out and the neutral one's giving just that oxidative kind of element and like roundness? Or what would the difference between those two be for the wine?
The analogy I use is you have to think of barrels like a tea bag. So the first time you put your wine in there, you're going to extract 80 to 90% of the potential, right? And then by the time you get to the third fill, what you're getting is a container that isn't going to impart anything aromatically or texturally. It's a neutral container that, depending upon how you treat it, can provide a little bit of that micro ox that you were talking about or not, depending upon, again, whether you let it dry fully before you fill it. All of these things are like, all these are details that have to be decided at the margin. And we'll do that. We'll look at, in some of our bigger, brawnier vintages, we'll let our barrels dry out after washing them before filling them back up again. So we get a little bit of that micro ox. Likewise, in more delicate vintages where we don't want to sacrifice some of those really beautiful aromas, we'll actually fill them in when they're still somewhat moist. And that prevents the oxygen from going in there and oxidizing some of those really delicate aromas. But yeah, to your point, after three fills, essentially, you're dealing with a neutral container, a useful one, but certainly not one that's going to be imparting anything specific to the wine.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. All right, cool. I want to pivot here now to, I guess there's two fields of questions that I kind of want to go down, and I'll let you choose which one.
Sure.
I want to lean towards questions in terms of sustainability, what you guys are doing around the winery and what impacts you've seen over your time there from climate change, if any. And then the other side too will be, and I guess these kind of intertwine, is your use of technology and how you're maintaining this quality while also in heritage, and then also using some of the new technology to help do so and enhance that.
Yeah. Okay. I think we can attack both of those head on. So, the way we look at this is that winemaking really is a three-legged stool. There's the creative side of it. It's a really important part of the business. That's the artistic side. There's the technical sides. That's the being an operator as well as being a creator. And then the third leg is farming. And so I think one of the strengths of Montalena is that the people who have come before me as winemaker have recognized that in one form or another, and the importance of each. That not everybody was equally strong in all three areas and as another, but everyone recognized the importance of those. We just certainly had people who were stronger technically than others, et cetera, et cetera. Sustainability ties into that. Sustainability is hard to define, right? There's no great working definition. I think the three E's are good. That came out of Lodi Rules, I think. So that's what you want to do. You want to focus on environment, economics, and equity. I look at it as more as stewardship. Mm-hmm. And it's about doing the right thing. One of the great parts about being a family-owned business is that we understand that our two greatest assets are our people and our land, and we would never do anything that could possibly harm either of them. So it's less about, and I'm not saying you insinuated this, but a lot of people do, is it's less about checking off boxes when it comes to you must do A, B, C, D, E, and F, and G before you're considered sustainable. For us, it's more cohesive. We do everything. We're a solar-powered winery. It's the right thing to do. Where we compost everything from our grape seeds to our coffee grounds and everywhere in between. And I think that the level of precision that we follow now in the vineyard, we're saying that good farming practices, whether it's for irrigation or soil health, like that's great for wine quality. It's great for our people. And it's really good for the bottom line. We can dig into it in any way you want, but they're tools that we use, I guess, is what I would say. And we don't really buy into any specific philosophy. It's because that can be somewhat limiting. So we really try to keep our minds open and look at what's the right tool for the job. And in sustainability, there's always a lot of thou shalt nots. I'm being told what I can't do. But we always look at what's the best thing for the land, what's the best thing for our people, what's the best thing for the winery. And I'd say everything we do lines up with all three of those.
Nice. Yeah, I wrote my WSET diploma research paper on sustainability. And I think something that when I talk to a lot of different winemakers, not everybody, but the people part doesn't come up until the very end. So it's awesome to hear that you have it just top of mind right off the bat. So that makes sense.
It's a huge part of it. I think we had our vineyard foreman retire. He was like employee number six, started here in 1974 and he just retired. And it's, man, that guy has seen just generations of people come through here. And I think that's been one of the strengths of Montelena. Like our average employee tenure here is like, it's been like 14 years or something crazy like that. So it's a really special place to work, and people are first and foremost here. And that's something I think the Barrett family has really made a priority for us.
Nice. So I guess take us a little bit into the technology side.
Sure.
You guys have mentioned that. Is this coming in the winery with a bunch of small tanks that allow you to do some micro vinification? Yeah. Tell us some of that stuff.
Yes. Yeah, so it's all of the above. And as I alluded to before, I don't really look at winemaking and the viticulture, the vineyard, as being separate anymore. And so anything we do in one place or the other should have a reflection or at least a ripple effect into the other side. And so it starts obviously with, we can look at it. Let's just pick on irrigation for a second. There are a lot of places in Napa Valley where you can dry farm, and dry farming's awesome if you can do it. We grow, our site is all volcanic rock and all alluvium cobbles. So there's no water in our soils. We in most years, we do have to provide some supplemental irrigation. And so the question is, how do we do that? And we use a combination of subsurface soil meters, which are incredibly useful. We work with a company. We were one of the first customers for a friend of mine who I went to grad school at Davis with, and he started a company that allows us to measure how much water our vines are using in real time, is really super cool. That opens up the world to so many different things when you now all of a sudden you can quantify things. And
is that from like sensors in the soil or like what?
No, it's above ground, which is wild.
Measure the flow up, or
so it doesn't matter. It doesn't directly measure evapotranspiration, which is what I think you're asking. It uses a technology called surface renewal, and it's essentially measuring like the wind eddies coming across the vineyard with a lot of math. We could geek out on this for an hour and a half, but just safe to say that it's incredibly precise. And what that does is it instead of saying, okay, you don't have any more water in your soil, what this technology allows us to do is saying, okay, if I know the stress level I want to maintain in my fruit, because I know on the winemaking side how it expresses when these vines are stressed, that piece of technology allows us to say, okay, we should probably irrigate here. But when we do, the old rule of thumb was like, oh, just throw 3 or 4 gallons per vine on. It's no, to maintain this stress level, the vines need 0.7 gallons or something like that.
Wow.
And so it's really about getting into that level of precision that saves water, obviously, that increases wine quality, all those things that we're looking for. And everything ties into that. Like our new row orientation, we set it up specifically in a way in terms of how we have the vines trained. We don't have to do leafing anymore. We don't have to do any canopy management. So I don't have to send a crew out in the middle of the day in July when it's 90 degrees and they're out there pulling leaves all day. So and that helps our people. That allows our people to do smart things. Likewise on the winery, you know, some of the automation we've brought in, like our automated pump overs, the reason to do it wasn't to like, oh, we want to cut labor out or we want to homogenize everything. It was like, no, I want my people to be able to do smart things. Having my cellar master who's been here for 30 years sitting on top of a tank with a hose doing a pump over, like not a great use of his brain. So we let the robots do it. And that gives us an incredible amount of flexibility. Like you said, for micro vinification, I can pump over a tank 25 times now in a day if I want to. Whereas before I was having to pull people, our valuable people, and we're not that big. We have a cellar crew of 4 and then me and Jamie, our assistant winemaker. So there aren't that many of us. And being able to utilize technology now to make the wine better is really and to give our people the opportunity to do things that are more befitting of their level of intelligence and skill is really what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. As someone who's worked in a large winery and had to do those pump overs, I think that's number one. It's like people don't understand how, like you said, annoying it is to carry these big
giant hoses.
Hoses. That's the term. Yeah. Up and down. But also the quality of the wine benefits because like for us, they had two shifts. We were there in the middle of the night pumping over. And you also don't want people just working 12 hours in the middle of the night.
That's right.
You can do these whenever you want without doing that. And then also, even when it comes to, I guess you guys don't do these as much, probably like punch downs too. It's like, you don't necessarily have somebody's face over a big batch emitting CO2.
That's right.
They always told us like, these bars are here because people used to fall in the tanks. And it's, that's
bad news.
Yeah.
And so for instance, for the pump overs, so one of my friends here in St. Helena, he owns a machine shop. He developed, he 3D printed these really beautiful pump over heads, and he worked, his partner's a mechanical engineer. I think he's a doctoral student at Stanford. And so they went through the fluid dynamics and they 3D printed out all these different heads and designed this amazing way to do these incredibly precise layered pump overs that get really good cap coverage. And so it's like all of these little steps, while, you know, on their own, don't really seem to amount to much. But when you take them all together and seeing how they compound from, again, having the flexibility to change temperature up and down, being able to do that on my phone as needed, we can change temperatures during pump overs, to do 25 pump overs, to 100 pump overs a day, whatever we decide to do. Then at the same time, doing it in a way that's, again, better for our fruit, better for our people, and that allows us to give feedback back to the vineyard. Like I can give you a, for instance, this year, one of my favorite blocks on the property is one of our alluvial blocks, and it's literally just 10 feet of straight cobbles. There's no soil. It's a very structural, big kind of brawny block. And I noticed this year that while the fruit was excellent, it wasn't in tank, it wasn't outstanding like it normally is. Don't get me wrong, it was A quality, but it wasn't A plus like it normally is. And so we were like, what the heck's going on? And we're tasting. I taste all of our tanks twice a day. And Jamie, our assistant winemaker, she's doing all of the phenolic analysis here in the lab. And there's just something that's a little bit off. And so we were able to go back again using, we have the data from on the winemaking side. And then we were able to look back at the VIT data saying, okay, when did we start irrigating this block? We figured out we started irrigating this block like 2 weeks earlier than normal last year. And it wasn't that much water. It was just like a couple gallons, but it's during a pretty critical time after fruit set when in general, you don't really want to irrigate much if you don't have to. And so we were able to have a conversation, me and Jamie and our vineyard manager, about some of the decisions we made. And there was some heat coming in. We weren't sure how to do it. But I'm convinced that extra early irrigation had an effect on how that fruit was expressing. And so again, like these are tiny little marginal details, but those are the things that we obsess over because that's what you guys expect from us. If you're going to lay a bottle down for 40 years and you're buying a wine for your kid's birth or the year you got married, like the wine's got to deliver. And so like we have to obsess over little details like that. And so for this year, we'll be watching that even more closely than we were last year.
Wow. That's fascinating. I love how those little things, this is why I try to get people more into the winemaking and the viticultural process. Cause don't think about these little things that actually go into what you're actually experiencing in the glass. That's so cool.
Totally.
All right. Thinking about 40 years, we have a little bit of time left. What are you looking at? What are you most excited for the future of Chateau Montelena and like maybe just the near term and then looking longer than that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So again, 2022 was the 50th anniversary of Barrett's stewardship of this property. And Bo was unequivocal when he said that we need to build the foundation for the next 50. And so it's all the things we're working on right now. So it's what's going on in the vineyard. It's what's going on in the winemaking. Again, we're a small company. Again, I think people think we're like massive, but we're not. We're a tiny little company. And so we just have a big reputation. We make a lot of noise for a small brand. And so what I really love is the sort of the interdisciplinary approach. So like I help work with the branding team and we don't have a marketing person or anything like that. We all work together in a way that's trying to elevate not only the wines, but in the experience for our guests. To me, that's really exciting. I love wearing my creator hat. And so we've got some really fun projects coming down the line. As I mentioned before, it's every good idea I have for winemaking takes like 10 years to come to fruition. While we have this really wonderful vineyard designate from our estate vineyard and our Cabernet, I think we'll be looking at in the future, looking at some of those individual colors using that analogy that we paint with right now, looking at some specific blocks that we could tease out and possibly bottle on their own. We're going to be moving most likely back into Sonoma on the Chardonnay side. Been playing with that for the last few years, but it's fun. Again, that's That's the wonderful thing about Mauna Lena, is that we have this like freedom to be creative and this independence. And I've told people over the years, I love working for somebody like for Bo, who's a production guy. Like, he gets it. He's not a, I have no problem with salespeople. They're great people, but I love working for someone in production because it allows us to come up with these ideas and these experiments. At any one point in time, I probably have between 20 and 40% of my winemaking lots in some kind of R&D. And so that's usually surprises people for a very classic brand. It's no, like, we are continuing to push the element, whether it's with new wines, new viticultural practices. Like, we're really proud of our position as being a leader. And if I had to make the same wine every single day, every single year, I'd go nuts. So being able to come up with these like really fun projects that show something special to our customers and also like quite edifying on their own is what makes me happy.
Yeah, no, I think we've continued to hear this as a theme. The CEO of Bilcart, Simon, or Bilcart, also said the tradition is innovation that works. Basically,
exactly, you keep right.
Trying all these new things, and that's the way you're able to maintain the same caliber of quality over all these time.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think like the way you respect that tradition is by innovating, because that's what got you here in the first place. So I'm exactly. Sure you would agree. Mm-hmm.
Everything at one point was an innovation. Right. Thank you so much for joining today, and we really appreciate your time.
Hey, I really enjoyed it. Hope to talk to you guys again.
All right. And that was our interview with Matt, head winemaker at Chateau Montelena. I hope everybody learned a lot about all the effort that they put into making their wines and took away a little bit more knowledge about barrels in particular. That is our episode for this week. We will be back with another interview and another episode next week. Cheers.
To check out our current offerings and to sign up for the Vint platform, find us at www.vint.co. That's www.vint.co. For questions, comments, or feedback on the Vint podcast, please email us at support@vint.co. Vint and VV Markets are offering securities pursuant to Regulation A. Our offering circular as amended can be found on the SEC website. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Investments such as those on the Vint platform are speculative and involve substantial risks to consider before investing. We may provide communication that may contain certain forward-looking statements that are subject to various risks and uncertainties. Information provided in any communications, including this podcast, is not legal, business, or tax advice. All prospective investors should consult a legal, tax, or business advisor concerning the subject matter of any communications and any offering.